Hi, and welcome to Prosody, WESA's weekly show featuring the work of poets and writers. I'm Jan Beatty, and my guest today is the poet Thomas McCarthy. Thomas McCarthy was born in County Waterford. He was educated at University College Cork and worked for many years at Cork City Libraries. As well as two novels and a collection of essays and diaries, he's the author of several collections of poetry, including The Sorrow Garden, The Lost Province, Merchant Prince, and most recently, The Last Geraldine Officer and Pandemonium, which was just released in 2016 to much acclaim. He has held positions as Honorary Fellow of the International Writing Program at University of Iowa and as Professor of English at Macalester College, and is former editor of Poetry Ireland Review and Cork Literary Review. His writing has received numerous accolades, including the Patrick Kavanagh Award and the Alice Hunt Bartlett Prize, and has been translated into Chinese, French, German, Italian, Portuguese, and Dutch, among other languages. He lives in Cork, and we've been really fortunate to have him visiting Pittsburgh for the last number of days and visiting Carleigh University. So welcome, Thomas McCarthy.
Thanks very much, Jan. It's been absolutely great to be here. My first time in Pittsburgh, which I've been hearing a lot about, even in Europe, in all of the English language newspapers. Pittsburgh now is like becoming a go-to city.
Really?
Yeah. It's
That's
got
good
features
news.
In newspapers and things like that, which is really interesting mm-hmm. because it is a post-industrial city, like the city I live in Ireland. Cork, which was a once Ford Motor Company city,
okay.
the Detroit of Ireland. People often complain about American companies going abroad to set up factories in Europe. But in fact, this year, 2017, is the 100th anniversary of the first American factory in Ireland, which is amazing to think of. But really, it's actually great to be here for poetry's sake rather than motor cars. It's brilliant to be wandering around the beautiful campus in Carleigh University.
Well, we're really, really happy to have you and happy to have you on Prosody. So you're going to read some poems for us.
Yeah, I'd love to read some poems. This is an earlier poem from one of my books I'll read here from Mr. Dineen's Careful Parade. This poem is called The Waiting Deputies. And it's about a night I remember well, the general election in Ireland, held in November 1991 during very, very heavy rain. Rain isn't unusual in Ireland, but torrential rain is. And it was an election that was held in torrential rain, which made everybody bad-tempered. But this is about a night I drove through my native county of Waterford just as the polling stations were closing and all of the physical boxes full of voting papers were being collected and the lights were going out in the polling stations. So this poem is called The Waiting Deputies. Tonight I drive through my native county, 10 o'clock, all the canvassing over. The lights go out in the last polling booth. Incumbents await their final transfer. What is it that my childhood meant to say, I wonder? Just one version of the truth will out tomorrow when seals are broken. I drive through the latest interregnum as November rain drove through here for weeks. Posters lie torn in the exhausted towns of Dungarvan and Lismore. The rainstorm of polling day has abated. The night speaks to me like an old detective. It protects boxes and seals power. Who will be responsible for my childhood when the votes are counted? Where will the blame fall? The way I live now prevents any party from looking good. What I write, remember, and feel excludes me from their well-connected world. When I was poor, these men did business as if nothing happened. I was told they had power to attend to. They used to sail in and out of our demented terrace. The unopened boxes will see me write. My parish sleeps on its pillow of votes. Capoquin, between the river and the trees, ignores its grumbling questioner, its poet. It sleeps upon favours. In the calm of night, they wait with me, the would-be deputies. And this poem, in a way which is a little connected with the last poem, is a poem about my father, who, when I was still quite young, maybe I was 8 or 9, had a nervous breakdown, my father did, and really was never the same again. And so we really spent the rest of our childhood minding our father. And I often think of that and the effect it has on children. Thinking of my father in the Musée Picasso. It breaks my heart to think of your failures, for you were not a bad man, just hopeless. The lost party, those lethal social forces that broke your will, broke others less poor. Talent is a muscle that needs constant exercise, and Ireland was your disagreeable milieu. All the end-of-term banter of the Doyle couldn't hide that truth. But look at Picasso. He was a bullish, besieged Stalinist, yet he worked and worked and worked. Every butterfly of an idea he embraced became art, and every false move he made used material more permanent and beautiful than the Dáil. I should explain that the Dáil is the Irish Parliament. And this poem, still thinking of my father really, is called Picasso's Composition au Papillon. When I contemplate your magic gifts tonight, alone, the back boiler creaking, the frosty moonlight, I am reminded that you were Leonardo reincarnate, the Cucullin of canvas. Paint never buckled under such pressure. Guernica, vulgar goats, portraits of Olga, even something as brittle as Composition au Papillon has the finished look to make gods finite. In Paris, at 51, you could play God with cloth, string, a thumbtack, oil. Truth is, we are all born to an artless, provincial stench. If we are lucky, Picasso, we die French.
If you just tuned in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Jan Beatty, and my guest today is the poet Thomas McCarthy, reading his poetry. I love that. I mean, I love many lines, but I love that line, when I was poor, these men did business as if nothing happened. So strong, it just jumped out. I guess I want to ask you, how much do you think actual politics, as in what's happening in the parliament, etc., becomes a motivator for your poetry?
Certainly, when these poems were being written, it was the main motivator for my poetry, I think. And I wrote 2 novels about the same subject matter. And one of the characters I had invented in my poems went into one of my novels. And I think it's very difficult to avoid politics in Ireland. It's because I think Irish people just love politics anyway, because it's all about human engagement. It's, in a sense, a great wealth. Politics, it's a wealth of words and of arguments. And, you know, even the penniless people can engage in that powerful game. And I think that's why Irish people are attracted to it so much. And also, there is always a sense in Irish life that even if things are very, very bad, there must be a political action that can make things right. Mm-hmm. I think the Irish have that in their blood from the years of kind of the liberation wars.
Mm-hmm. Well, regardless of what poem you're reading, I always get the sense of a voice that's willing to talk about the difficult thing, whether it's politics or not, that the voice in the poem doesn't back off at all, which I love about your work. And yet there's a lot of subtlety in your work also. So I always feel that push and pull inside your lines.
Well, I think the best poetry for me is nearly always a quiet kind of poetry. There's an implacable arrogance in very quiet people that I love. And my mother was like that. People who are shy are always so strong, really. And I think some kinds of poetry are like that. And it may seem like the opposite of politics. For me, politics, I mean, I love I love the physicality of politics as well. I love election campaigns. I mean, my whole life is transformed if an election is called. Even though I'm not involved in any way in politics now, but I go into overdrive mentally. I love posters. I love election posters. I love, they're, to me, they're like flowers. They're flowering. They're, when I see, I mean, I drive down the street or drive through the countryside and I see posters hanging from street lamps, posters hanging from blackthorn bushes, posters, you know, in the windows of pubs, even sometimes posters on rooftops and in the most unusual places in Ireland. And to me, it's a kind of flowering of human power and possibility in a quite a grey landscape sometimes, you know.
That sounds like a poem to me.
Well, it just describes what, you know, the British poet Philip Larkin once said, you know, that loneliness to him was like daffodils to Wordsworth. Well, really, election posters are like daffodils to me, you know, very much so.
That's great. Could you read more poems?
I will. Let me read just a more personal one.
Okay.
One about the sea, about my wife, Catherine, who loves the sea, particularly the seacoast of County Kerry, and she keeps going back to the sea. And when I met her first, many, many, many years ago, she actually was photographing the sea. I remember she had an installation when she was an art student in a local art gallery, and she had been taking little pharmacist's bottles, you know, all those little coloured bottles that hold pharmaceuticals in them from the old days, and she was bringing them down to the seashore and photographing them as the tide came and went and the sunlight fell on the colours. And that was the kind of person she is, you know, the sea is always ebbing and flowing in her consciousness. So this poem is called The Fiction, The Sea. You keep returning to the sea as if you'd lost a bracelet in the water or some such valuable and peaceful thing. It is part of the problems of being a girl, my mother always said, such possessions as become windows and mirrors to call a woman back to demand closing. Or as Henry James said, for he was no mother, as the picture is reality, so the novel is history, and not as the poem is, a metaphor and closed thing. Strange how I could never go back to the spit of sand, the sea warren of the Cunniger in Dungarvan Bay, for I would never want to deconstruct what was never whole, what was tentative and poorly given, what it was that I chased after among blue razor shells. But I digress, for this is about you returning late in the summer to a wild and restless sea. It is you, grown restless from inadequate sunshine, turning back like a pilgrim to inhale the iodine of the far west, going farther as you must, to meet the sea halfway, the sea in its life being more entrenched than us and far more Flaubertian. So what of that bracelet, then? And where did that come from? Nothing but salt at the very edge of summer before it flips away forever, salt and sand that makes a kind of mirror. Nothing but salt is left on the hard pavement out of the sea, and kelp too, and its iodine, all strewn on the cold water. As you figure and pick among things like a novelist, the tide bathes your whitened toes, it advances and recedes. My own beloved, the sea's droll pathos kisses you. It is your fable spinner, giving us knowledge abundant and vicarious.
Nice, I love that poem.
That's my sea poem.
Yeah.
I have another poem here. It's not about the sea, but it's kind of about the ebb and flow of history, an Anglo-Irish luncheon party. I grew up in West Waterford, which is an unusual place on the River Blackwater, mentioned in Joyce's Ulysses. Molly Bloom's first lover came from the place I came from, Capoquin in County Waterford. And it's an unusual place in that it has quite a vibrant Anglo-Irish Protestant community, as well as the usual Irish Catholic community. And it's a community that's lived in kind of peaceful coexistence, really, for hundreds of years, with no disturbance and no trouble. So I imagined this moment with my father and the two politics, one Protestant, one Catholic, one contemporary, one historical, an Anglo-Irish luncheon party. I was with my father chasing the last seven votes, like a young curate of the old school delivering repeal cards, when this party of the Belle Assemblée passed us by near Lismore Bridge. It was a procession like no other. It was fine women carrying the torch of life. "Look at them," said my father, "a luncheon meeting of the one and only Distressed Women's Relief Fund. History is silk. Grief is a watercolour. Death in such company is a black bead from Vesuvius." My father and I let them pass by. Lady Keane, a Miss Musgrave, the late Mrs. Wise, Miss Healy, and others. It was all Egyptian red cloth, pomegranate blossom, barbel blue, turquoise stone, a glavina pin, a velvet Bolivar hat. I thought upon our own ornaments that we carried, two party cards, two ash hurling sticks, two copies of The Nation. How such ornaments glittered for us in a different light. An ornate bridge was trimmed with olive green trefoils of satin. The Capuquin Road wore a strict court mourning, each to her black scarf of barege silk, my father said, each to her fallen.
If you just tuned in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Jeanne Beatty, and my guest today is the poet Thomas McCarthy, reading his work. Now, with almost any poet, I would think of how does sound work in these poems, but listening to you or reading your work, it feels different. It feels like sound as a necessity, sound as kind of bursting again and again. And I, yet it never feels like too much. So I wonder how you, you know, when you compose, but then when also when you revise your poems, do you ever find yourself cutting back on sound? Are you like exploding with sound in your work, or does that change poem to poem?
I think my head is just full of historical conversations. Mm-hmm. I read a lot.
Mm-hmm.
Read a lot of diaries. I love diaries, historical diaries, writers' diaries, political diaries, the diaries of statesmen and the diaries of poets. But I think it's from the force of the kind of archive of those conversations in my head that the sound of history is always in my head, you know. And it's in the writing of poetry, a lot of the time, it was a process of selecting those sounds from history. It was the sound of things being discussed, or the sound of things coming to power, that really interested me, you know, and how power makes a sound in history that poets are very close to, I think. Poetry is nearly always, in the end, about some kind of power, certainly in Irish politics, where the poets were always close, either to revolution or to power itself, you know. So that power comes into the poetry, I think.
Sure.
That's what I'm trying to get. That's what I'm trying to get at.
Yeah. So naturally coming in from the voices in your head,
yeah,
and from what you've read.
Yeah.
I like what you gave an amazing reading at Carlo University recently, and I liked what you said about the times now not being so bad. And it was at that moment that I was thinking about your historical knowledge differently, you know, because no one really talks like that. Do you know what I'm referring
to?
Yeah.
I know I often get distressed for people. I am upset for them when they think that this world is a bad world, the one we live in now. And even, I mean, there are so many Americans, particularly highly educated Americans, who are distressed. They think we're living in really bad times in America. I mean, that is such a historical error. There were terrible times in American history, and now is nothing like them. How terrible American things might feel now for some intellectuals, especially in America, these things are very manageable, you know. They'll pass away quietly. But I feel that people sometimes really need to read more history. I mean, and unfortunately, we have a tendency now in our education systems in Europe and in America to belittle history for the sake of computers. We have sort of think that memory is about computers, and we're sort of going to assemble all our expertise and even our aesthetic lives and put them into computer format, digitize our thinking. That will never happen.
Mm-hmm.
The whole thing about life is that it's actually a human experience more than anything else. And the words of our humanity and our memory all come to play in the way we should live. And part of, I think, the really crucial memory and its power in our lives should be a sense of history, you know. I mean, I'm spending a lot of time recently now reading the works of Ausonius, Decimus Maximus Ausonius, who was a poet who lived in the transition period at the end of the Western Empire, the end of the Roman Empire, in the year, say, 350 of the Christian era to 400 of the Christian era. A poet who lived a very long life. I think he lived through 24 Roman Olympiads. And he thought the world was gone to the dogs because there were all these, this new cult coming from the East called Christianity. And these Christians were disrupting thinking about the world, making people think about other worlds, when the duty of a Roman citizen was to think of this world, not the next one. And so he was very distressed about this. And he thought the whole thing would fall apart. He was correct. The Roman Empire did fall apart. But Christianity came in its place and the great Christian civilization of the West. So, you know, I think of Ausonius's distress when one of his best students decided to become a Christian. And instead of looking after his family estates and taking care of the sort of Western consulship that was in his gift, he ran off and took care of a Christian shrine in the mountains, like somebody in the 1960s California. And so the distress that the poet Ausonius, who was a man of property and became actually consul in later life, the distress he felt about the irresponsibility of the young and the catastrophic collapse of civilization is a distress we share with him. But that was 1,600 years ago in the life of humanity. So we shouldn't think that the distress we feel is terrible or so terrible that it can't be solved, you know?
Okay. Okay, we have time for a few more poems.
Yeah. I'll read you some of the poems from Pandemonium.
Great.
Called Pandemonium.
And that's published by Carcanet Press.
In Manchester, in England. My old publisher, Anvil Press Poetry, folded, and Carcanet Press has taken over the entire list. So we came with the stable.
Okay.
Where there are now horses running in the Carcanet colours. This poem is The Land Not Settled, and it's really about Ireland and the crisis, the great financial crisis that destroyed Ireland for about 8 years. Ireland has absolutely bounced back, but there were years of being depressed. The land is not settled. The land is not yet settled. After our years of pandemonium. This time it is almost too late to sing with full heart a parting hymn or indulge in the usual fickle humour of things. It is too late to bolt the door of Ireland. A penny candle struggles in the wind. A corpse from the west rises to face me. What was a house now stands as a ghost from the assizes. Believe me, I tried to understand all the signals we received from Berlin. Little did they know, in our autonomous region, all the gold was gorse and all investment was storytelling. Blackbirds in the oak trees are trembling still where all our demons hurriedly went in. But I've spent during these years of the Irish financial crisis. I spent really an awful lot of time with my wife Catherine by the sea, following her along the seashore of West Kerry. And so a lot of the poems actually were simply just written within moments of leaving the seashore. So a lot of the poems have the sea in them. This one, become water, like us. The tide is seeking a cove where it doesn't need to be obliging. Love, in its secret cave, may rise and fall to its own moon. The beckoned call of the sea won't be heard. The cliff face runs its mascara, such tears of disgrace as leave the rocks with purple stains. It is clear the sky has taken pains to shoo such clouds away as might freckle the foreshore from a great height. The tide's scandalous incompetence is complete. The sea runs out of patience with every form of rock and pool. This tide of love has never bent to any school, but ebbs in its own petulant way, the way art or water does, you say, the way all things that are fought for settle in a hidden cove and accept water. This poem, at ink level, the sea. Here on the writing desk of the earth, the sun goes down quickly at ink level. Soon the stony outcrop will be a blob of light blue, and the sky will be pale as the tissue rises. Is it time to go in, or is it time to go outside? Only time will tell me how the levels rise. Phrases cluster on the sunlit page. So many oyster catchers thread the surf. Their needlepoint becomes pale green. Water is near. Shale bursts in applause. Gulls congregate on a drifting raft. Am I going out or coming in with the sea? Not everything is blessed by the promise of water. Your book on birds is soaked by the wash. Ink grows pale in its buckled galleys. From the Hellespont of a paperclip, Leander swims to me. Petrichor. Petrichor is a word that I love, one of those lovely words, which is the smell in the air after rain, after a long dry spell. Petrichor. Our kitten turns to deliver its encomium, purring as if a lump of tabby quartz propelled it so. It shares this petrichor with the last bumblebees seeking glamour. Wet stones release their chatoyant gaze as I shake Molly's cocktail shaker. Here is quartered lime after unexpected rain. We have lost our house, but earth is warm beneath your cherished tintinabulation.
The poetry of Thomas McCarthy. Thank you so much for coming from Ireland to be here.
Thank you too. It was lovely to be here.
You've been listening to Ferocity, WESA's weekly show featuring the work of poets and writers. Writers appearing on Prosody also have their work showcased in Chapter and Verse, a biweekly feature in Pittsburgh City Paper, the Arts Entertainment News Weekly, published every Wednesday. Prosody is produced by Jan Beatty. Our sound engineers are Michelle Stoner and Lisa Alexander. Please tune in every Saturday morning at 6:30 for Prosody 90.5 WESA.